Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. With today's guest, former Governor Eliot Spitzer, the show returns to its beginning. Eliot Spitzer was the program's first guest back in February 2010. Governor Spitzer is here in Syracuse to help launch another Campbell Institute initiative, a debate series on significant public issues. Look for a WRVO broadcast of this debate 2 weeks from now. Governor Spitzer, thanks for participating in that, and thanks for returning to the program.
It is great to be here to celebrate the anniversary, and congratulations on your success.
Thanks very much. I wanted to spend some time exploring this new unit on mortgage origination and securitization abuses that the President announced in his State of the Union address. And this is an area that you certainly know a lot about, going back to your days as a prosecutor and attorney general, and it's something that you've written about since then. And basically, the President announced, as I understand it, a unit that will focus on the misconduct by financial institutions regarding the writing and guaranteeing of mortgages, and it will have the power to prosecute. President Obama seems to have become more aggressive on this issue of late. How much of a departure for him is this move, looking at his presidency so far?
Well, a couple different perspectives on this. First, clearly, as you framed the question, it is correct. He appears to be more aggressive now than he had been 6 months ago, a year ago, or 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when the banks were being given huge sums of money with no inquiry about what caused the crisis or no expectation at that moment of remedial action on their part. 2 years, 3 years hence, the political world has changed. The absence of prosecutions, the accepted wisdom, which I think is accurate, that there were major defalcations within the banks, rating agencies, regulatory bodies throughout, and yet nobody has been held accountable. The frustration bordering on overt anger expressed throughout the public has led to a necessary political response. And so the President is basically saying, let's restart this process. Eric Holder, as Attorney General of the United States, and Eric Schneiderman as Attorney General of New York State, who was asked to also be one of the leaders of this group, the President is saying, do something about this. Now, certainly, we're all happy that the scrutiny will now be brought to bear. Your question, is this really a genuine change in intellectual perspective? Cynics would say this is election year fluff. The populism we've heard from the President in his, I thought, very effective speech in Kansas now 2 months ago, but somewhat vapid, gauzy, what follows from it. Is this more of the same? One doesn't know until we see how people act. And I'm heartened that he has stepped up to the plate and acknowledged that the absence of prosecutions is both wrong and frustrating and should be remedied. I think that he is now in a position where he must give latitude to those who want to bring the prosecutions. Now the burden falls on Eric Holder and Eric Schneiderman to make the cases.
And one of the things I wanted to follow up on that, when you mentioned, you know, what the cynics would say or what the people who are more suspicious would say, is when we look at the Obama administration, it does seem to be heavily reliant on prominent people from the financial sector, if you look at people's backgrounds and key White House appointments. And so that I wanted to get your sense of how would you assess Obama's handling of the assessment of responsibility and the accounting for the crisis so far? It does sound like, in your view, not the best up until now.
Let's separate out two issues. One is the obligation on the part of the President to avert an economic cataclysm, and that is clearly priority two or three of the presidency, number one being security issues, of course. But they succeeded in doing that, but they then failed in the corollary obligation to restructure our financial system in a way that prospectively will bring long-term prosperity. What we did in the crisis was shovel huge volumes of money into the pockets of the banks through guarantees, direct cash payments, buyouts, bailouts, all the various mechanisms available, without asking that anything be done in response or as a quid pro quo here being a good term. As we're giving you $10 billion of cash, we expect you to change your business practices and your business models so you don't do it again. To come back to the premise of your question, I think a large part of it does go to the leadership within the administration, Tim Geithner in particular, who emerged from Wall Street, not having worked at one of the firms, but having been the president of the New York Fed, perhaps the most critical regulatory position in terms of overseeing the banks. And so he built the very edifice that fell apart, leading to the crisis. He did not, oddly, believe we needed fundamental structural reform when he became Treasury Secretary. And he, sort of like Jamie Dimon, stuff like this happens sometimes. Well, no, it doesn't. And it didn't for the 50 years that we had Glass-Steagall in place, that we had a more rigid regulatory framework. Banks did what banks were supposed to do before they became casinos. And so, yes, I think the first couple years of this administration, there was not the DNA in the White House that believed in fundamental reform. Now that's changing a little bit, although Geithner is still there. We'll have to wait and see what happens. I said, hope you can believe in became continuity you can believe in with many of his cabinet appointments, unfortunately.
Well, and you mentioned Eric Holder, the Attorney General, and certainly he's been the focus of a lot of different criticisms and controversies. So do you have any different thoughts there, or do you see him as kind of an extension of the president this way?
Well, I think... Look, I don't know Eric Holder well. I've met him. I will not say anything negative about him as an individual in terms of his handling of that office from an ethical perspective. And as some people would say, oh, well, he knows this too many people, or he was on this board, or he was on at a big firm, and therefore they had clients. I don't think that's it. I think it's a more subtle issue than that. It's a matter of worldview. And if you do not believe, if you've come to internalize the worldview of Wall Street or of the financial system and believe that the flaws were marginal and are at the fringe, then you don't go in for the sort of reform that Teddy Roosevelt or FDR sought at their moments of crisis. I think this president had around him Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, people who did not appreciate the depths to which our financial system was structurally flawed. And I think Eric Holder, to a certain extent, is part of that universe.
I want to come back, actually, to Teddy Roosevelt at the end of our conversation. But I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Elliot Spitzer. Well, let's think about this unit and what it might do, what it might achieve. What of real value could this new unit realistically achieve for borrowers?
Well, for borrowers, prosecutions don't normally lead to remedies in and of themselves. A prosecution where somebody goes to jail or even disgorgement of significant sums from the bank, the order of magnitude of what we need for borrowers is bigger than that. So now it could happen, and here's how. You would need to use prosecutions the way we tried to when I was AG, which is to say, okay, we found you violating this law, committing this impropriety. We're going to use that to negotiate with you a structural reform. Structural reform which would say you originated loans that you knew did not satisfy the creditworthiness of your own standards. You securitized them, the whole bit, the whole daisy chain of idiocy. What we're going to now require you as banks to do is write down the face value of these mortgages. That is the critical piece that has not happened heretofore. Borrowers, many of whom share some of the blame. I mean, let's confront it head on. People borrowed too much, borrowed more than they should have, borrowed more than they were able to pay back. That's wrong. It's bad. It leads to ugly stuff. Having said that, we need to write down the face values of these mortgages not to applaud the bad behavior, but for the good of our economy. For all of us. If we don't, the housing market will not come back. And so what I think the remedy that we need to see is the prosecutors and the Treasury Department and the White House together saying to the banks, look, you did all this stuff that was wrong. Part of the solution that we want is for you to chip in a huge sum of money, disgorge a huge piece of the profits you've made recently to help write down the face value of these mortgages, or else we will not get a housing market back.
And one of the things that I've read about this unit is that the potentially large numbers of attorneys and investigators that a national unit would be able to generate and field is a crucial factor in making it more likely to get results than what might happen at the state level. I wanted to get your sense of that, given your experience at the state level.
Yes and no. In other words, here's why I say yes and no. Look, clearly having the resources of the FBI, the Treasury Department, the Postal Service, all of those folks, thousands of people who can actually read the emails, go through the bank records, makes a difference. Having said that, when I was AG, and I hate to harken back to that as though, gee, somehow look what we did and use it as the counterpoint, but, we made a fair number of cases, tough cases. We had 12 lawyers in the unit, 12. Sometimes being small forces you to be more thoughtful, more creative, figure out where your leverage is, and use resources in a way that is more creative and ingenious than if you're so big and lumbering that you just do what is plodding and boring. I think part of the problem with the SEC, with the Treasury Department, with the IRS, with the Maine Justice, is that they are so big that there's nobody there saying, we've got to be really creative. And as a consequence, they don't look and think in a different way. So I analogize the SEC and General Motors and say they were quite similar. They both failed because they were too big. And so in a way, scale becomes the problem. And so, yes, it will be good for this unit to have resources, but resources sometimes can mask a lack of creativity.
Well, a follow-up on that, and thinking about how the politics of this is going to play out, there's going to be so many powerful interests and candidates and voices just looking for missteps, looking for mistakes in anything that happens from this unit. So I think, you know, you mentioned the problem being so big that you kind of plod along and become more bureaucratic. I would think that's going to push them to be that way too, because they're going to be so risk averse. The last thing we want to do is be bold, make a mistake, get called for it, and make the administration look bad.
You were making such a hugely important point. I have found you go into the Beltway, you enter that zone, that bubble of Washington, D.C., suddenly people become incredibly risk averse, because promotion is dependent upon you're not making a big mistake. And so you're fearful of error more than you are seeking the creativity that often leads you down a dry well. You know, creativity often takes you in places that don't work out. You got to accept that. But creativity is what we are lacking in Washington. It's the risk aversion that you talk about that is somehow the damper.
Well, I want to stick on this topic of this unit and what we might expect here. So let's imagine, though, that it doesn't become overly bureaucratic, and it does do some pretty forceful investigations and has the kind of conversations that you've described with the industry. What moves would you anticipate that the banks will make if they become seriously challenged by this unit?
I think that the banks will start playing defense and say, look, this was 5 years ago. We've changed our business practices. Don't now, at the moment when we are finally reaching a point of solvency, stability, and beginning to lend to the economy so it can grow again, don't push the entire economy back to the brink. In other words, they will say the public interest now is served by our stability, our being the banks.
We've heard this before. And
we've heard this before. We heard this at the point where they were receiving. Look, my favorite moment was when Goldman Sachs got the check for $12.9 billion, billion with a B, to unwind its exposure to AIG credit default swaps. Nobody has yet explained to me why they deserved that money, why they got it, what it was for. Taxpayer money, $12.9 billion. But they will say, look, we need the money or else we can't lend. The answer to that is, okay. And again, let's be honest about the difficulty of the dynamic here. Figuring out how to sanction corporations is a thorny problem. Do you take it out on the shareholders? Do you take it out on a mid-level executive who is doing what he was told? You may not be able to prove the criminal case against the executive. How do you take this amorphous entity that is a person under our Constitution, has First Amendment rights, we can't send it to jail, what do you do to it? Do you demand the resignation of the five people at the top who didn't supervise properly? That's one of the things I would have done. Mm-hmm. Do you demand disgorgement of this so that those who got bonuses for 10 years are told you give your money back because you cost taxpayers? The things you can do, but it's a hard issue. You know, exemplified by a sign from Occupy Wall Street, of all places, which said, we will know corporations are people when Texas executes one. And, you know, it kind of highlights, it's not easy, but so the corporations are going to say, you need us now. We need to figure out creative ways to sanction them, the people, make people pay financially and in terms of being thrown out of the industry.
Well, maybe short of an execution, but what are the chances that in all of this we'll see some people go to jail?
They grow thinner by the day. By people, let's refer not just to a mid-level trader. Some cases are being made now against traders who misvalued bonds on the trading desk. Those cases will be made. Some insider trading cases will be made. Will we see former CEO, CFO, members of the board go to jail? It gets hard to prove the intent, their criminal intent. There are so many buffers that there are in the real world what I call the facilitators, the lawyers, the bankers, the investment bankers, and the accountants who are there around the CEOs of big entities giving advice in documents that, of course, you can say as the CEO, well, I relied upon my lawyer's memo here. How I never would have thought this was wrong. And it makes it hard with that much paper floating around, usually to say somebody committed a crime.
And do you think that the banking system as a whole could be significantly restructured by what this unit does?
No, I don't think not by prosecutions out of this unit. The moment to restructure the banking industry was when Dodd-Frank was being crafted. And I think the bill gets a B, not a C or a C minus. It gets a B. There are some between Dodd-Frank, the additional capital requirements coming out of the regulatory world, primarily in Europe, the Volcker rule in particular out in Dodd-Frank. Things are changing, and the market is forcing banks to hold more capital, reduce their proprietary trading, hold loans they make on their own books as opposed to simply pushing them off to, you know, to somebody else's risk, so that we had this sort of disequilibrium. They got the upside, not the downside. Socialism for all of us and capitalism for them. This is changing slowly. And I think the financial services sector is in a cyclical moment where the years that preceded 2008, when they were just printing money and doing things that were crazy, those years are done. Partly for market reasons, partly regulatory reasons, partly Europe regulatory reasons, doesn't mean it will not come back 10 years from now.
Is there one thing that you could put on the top of, if it got a B, you know, the things that would make it an A, that you would put it on the top of your list of what you'd like to see added to it?
I would have gone back to Glass-Steagall.
Okay.
I mean, I would have separated investment banking and commercial banking. I think that in the world the regulatory framework that reigned from the Depression until repeal of Glass-Steagall, the notion that you want to play a game of high risk, high stakes, high profit investment banking, you do it, but not with public money. Fine. You know, we wish you the best, but not with guaranteed, federally guaranteed deposits where you're using our guarantee to then take those risks. And then when you get the upside, but things go bad, we bail you out. That led to a disequilibrium that made the decisions crazy.
In case you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Elliot Spitzer. Well, I had a different question, but it's a related topic. It's the story that has come out this week about Freddie Mac making investments that have higher payoffs when people don't or can't refinance their mortgages, which goes against the mission of the institution and has been receiving a lot of criticism. What are your reactions to this?
It just smells. You know, here's a public, quasi-public institution, now really a public institution, betting against people's ability to pay off their mortgages at the same time that the institution is refusing to help people refinance their loans. Now, I'm not sure if there was one person you can say, aha, he knew they were playing both sides against each other. But it's not the way we're supposed to do things. And we've got to move beyond simply the notion that, gee, I can make money betting against this, therefore I will do it. When they're using public resources, public assets, it just shouldn't have been done that way.
I wonder if some of that, to go back to our earlier conversation about the pressures on things, and I don't understand this, obviously, as well as you do, but the pressure then for some of these people making these investment decisions to be showing that they're going to make money.
Oh, yeah. Look, you go back to the Goldman, the Abacus transaction, which is the one where Goldman structured a CDO and put in loans that they knew would fail or believed would fail, and then Goldman bet against it. And, of course, the people to whom they sold the product were never told, hey, we're betting against it. There you have a direct conflict, and Goldman paid $500 million to get out of it. But the structure that led to that is exactly what you just described. People are saying, hey, how do we make money on this game? And it's not the way I think most people would want to see institutions making money.
Well, I had a question now about you and your future, and I know that you get asked this question all the time, and I think I probably asked it the last time you were on the program. But the way that you signed off on your final broadcast of In the Arena almost begs me to ask it, and here's where I'm coming back to Teddy Roosevelt. Here's what you said on your last program, quoting Teddy Roosevelt. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again. That sure sounds like a version of I Shall Return.
It certainly wasn't intended to lead one to that conclusion. I know it's susceptible to that interpretation. I'd be silly to deny that, but that's not why I ended with that quotation. I just think it is one of the most marvelous statements from one of the most brilliant people who's ever served in our government and been in our civil society. Teddy Roosevelt understood, and I named the show In the Arena for that quotation, and I want people to know, look, I appreciate doers more than critics. I'd been on the show a critic, and I am now a critic. I enjoy it. I love it. It's fun. But really, it is the gladiator who's risking his life in that arena. You know, maybe that's a little dramatic, but the people who are taking the incoming missiles day in, day out, willing to stand up and say, I'm doing this, I believe that, with all the flaws that we all carry into that arena, I applaud them. And look, I'll make no you know, won't try to be deceptive. Do I miss it? Of course I do. I don't know anybody who is in government at a high level who doesn't miss it. Does that mean I'm going to get back into it? No, because, you know, life is long. Life is complicated. I've had moments of great excitement and thrills and successes, and obviously the opposite as well. And what is worth doing prospectively, I don't know. But that quotation, I just think, is one of the marvelous statements of what the human emotion is all about.
I had another question that comes out of your experience with CNN, too. So you had some time being on the other side of this media public official divide, mm-hmm. being the critic. Did that give you any newfound appreciation for the task that the media has in making sense out of politics? Do you?
You know, somehow, whichever side I'm on is always right. No, I say that facetiously. I don't want anybody to take that out of context. It's yeah, look, I always tried to get along with the media. The media often overanalyze what politicians do, is what I always found. Sometimes, you know, a kiss is just a kiss. You know, it's just, guys, this is, you know, you do stuff and there's a greater level of examination. Sometimes, from the other perspective, politicians look at the media and scratch their heads and don't realize we just got to fill airtime. So, you know, there's a lot of babble back and forth. I think I appreciate both the rigors of both. I think being a good media critic, I mean, I mean not a critic of the media, but somebody in the media who is a smart, thoughtful analyst of public affairs is an extremely difficult task and worthy of great appreciation from all of us, just as, despite my earlier allusion to the quotation, that the folks in the arena really are the ones whom I personally respect the most.
And the other side of this, too, from this perspective of having this experience, do you have advice for the media to better perform its role as an information conveyor and an analyst when it comes to politics and policy?
Oh, boy, not really. I've tried to avoid pretending I have wisdom for either the media or politicians. I guess sometimes I say, give people the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people, as cynical as I am and can be and will continue to be, unfortunately, or not, sometimes people just are trying their best. And, you know, mistakes happen. Bad judgment calls get made. You try things and they don't work out, but you go on and try something else. But it is not always out of ill motive. So let's sometimes give people a bit more credit than we do.
And let me turn to the three questions at the end. I asked you these a couple of years ago, but I'd like to get your take on them again if I could. Things change.
This is tough. I mean, I wish I had thought about this. I would have gone back to see what I said, so I'm not totally inconsistent.
Well, the first one is, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Stretching my wings, which is, I don't think anything close to what I said back then. You know, and I say that in the past period of time, I've had the pleasure of teaching at City College of New York, which I love, writing for Slate.com, which I enjoy doing, running our family business, which I thoroughly enjoy, spending a bit more time with my family. So it has been an opportunity to do things in slightly greater depth than I had when I was in government.
Second, what's your worst trait?
I think I'm impetuous. And I think over time I've begun to realize sometimes being much more deliberate and not having an answer quite as quickly or not being willing to articulate an answer quite as quickly would have been very useful.
Third, what achievement in your creative or professional life so far has surprised you the most?
This may sound odd, that I actually thought I was pretty decent at politics in terms of dealing with people. I wouldn't say I was shy as a kid, but I really, and people when I was in government had a hard time believing me when I said this, but I never thought I would run for office because I was not the extrovert. I wasn't an introvert, but I was hardly the extrovert. I mean, I ran for seventh grade class president, lost, and, you know, I was not the kid in high school who was going to run for office. You know, my close friend still, Jason Brown, who was president of the student body at high school, and, you know, he was the guy who was really the, you know, the go-to guy. Not I. And so, you know, it surprised me a little bit.
That was Eliot Spitzer. You can hear the debate on increasing taxes on the wealthy that he participated in on Sunday, February 19th at 3 p.m., and again on Monday, February 20th at 10 p.m. Governor Spitzer, I want to thank you so much for talking with me again.
Real pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
Support comes from the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University, dedicated to the study and practice of citizenship, leadership, and public governance. Information at maxwell.syr.edu.